crazy and says, do you keep on thinking, hypochondriacs do that all the time. If they get a headache, they think they have a brain tumor. If they have a stomach ache, they think they have stomach cancer. And, they're too much in one end. They're always running to the doctor, always complaining, always getting tests, always, driving everyone crazy. But you can do the opposite and get into much more problem, much more danger. There's a lot of people who, they get a little ache or pain on the left side of their chest when they're 30 years old, and they say, hey, I pulled a muscle, which is fine because you're 30 years old, and hopefully you don't have any significant risks of arteriosclerotic heart disease. Now you kind of shift the frame of reference. He's now 79 years old, and he has pain on the left side of his chest, and it's going down the left arm. And he says, I remember when I was 30, I pulled a muscle, so probably another muscle. So he doesn't go to the doctor. So they don't find he had a heart attack. So they don't treat him. So he dies a day or two later. So that's obviously not a good thing. So too much of anything isn't a good thing. To live in a doctor's office, I wouldn't recommend it. It's not a fun place generally. But if you need a doctor, you should go to a doctor. If you need treatment, you should get treatment. If you need medication, you should take the medication. Because that's why a lot of times a lot of people are living to ripe old ages. If you discuss with them if they're taking any medication, they'll probably laugh at you and pull out a bag full of medication that they take. And, it's not fun, but better to live longer and take a couple of pills. So, like the old thing that they used to go on with Facebook. It's complicated. It's neither one end of the extreme or the other, in my humble opinion.
QSO. But, how to say, I lived without a doctor's visit for 17 years, that I went to a cardiologist for some discomfort, and the cardiologist assistant said, you have no problem at all, just sleep on your right side instead of your left side. So I did it, and they were right, they were totally right. That I could have maybe have gotten this information on the Google and
I think you fell out of the repeater, David. The point, though, is, and hopefully you hear me, the point is I would advise people not to take health opinions from automated algorithms on the Internet. That's like taking legal advice off of an algorithm, except that you might be sued and lose all your money, but at least you won't die. So, no, I don't suggest that you seek out medical assistance by automated algorithms on Google. I suggest that you actually visit physicians who are trained to examine and treat people accordingly and have gone through many years of training and passed many exams and continue to pass qualifying exams. So, it may just be that I'm an actual doctor. But Google does not take the place, and God knows WebMD doesn't take the place of a doctor. It takes the place of a nagging mother-in-law whose second cousin twice removed dated a doctor back in 1942.
KF2ZZQSO. KG2RY. Yeah. Well, the cardiologist did a good job.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that. Okay, there's someone who tries to come in and he ends up doubling with David. Do you want to try again?
Hi, Roy. It's Brian, KF2ZZ. I was just trying to get into the conversation, but I'll remain on the side until you're ready.
Okay, if you have something to say about the subject, feel free.
Well, I was interested in, I had one question. Has a pancreatic transplant ever been tried?
Not per se. They have taken small samples and inserted it in odd places of people's body and put people on immune suppressants to effectively operate the same way. Because of the way that the islets of Langerhans work producing insulin, you just have to hook it up to a blood supply. You don't need to have it at a specific location, and there's no particular innovation that's required, nerve fibers and such. So you can basically plant the cells that exist in a pancreas in your forearm, and if it takes, they should work fine.
What about taking the islet cells and changing them so they are not consumed by the immunosuppressant reaction? Not the immunosuppressant reaction, but the the immunity, the autoimmune condition.
Well, unfortunately, it kind of amounts to the proverbial closing the barn door after the horse has left the barn. You're not going to really know that a person has type 1 diabetes until the autoimmune disorder has blasted a lot of the insulin-producing cells and left people requiring, injections of insulin. So by then, those cells are dead and gone. So you have to figure out a way of growing new cells, which is what we're talking about today.
I understand now. So you're talking about basically like a stem cell kind of approach.
Yeah, it's exactly. They took our stem cells and they manipulated them to the point where they non-generalized and became islet cells and capable of producing insulin according to local levels of hormones that maintain glucose levels.
KG2RY.
Yes, David? David, are you out there? I think you're falling out of the repeater a lot. I don't know what's going on.
Somebody is putting carrier.
I'm sorry to hear that.
It's time to let go to the last subject that I have.
Okay, well, we'll go to your last subject and okay.
Okay, so you have something that is impossible. It looks like it's impossible. The 46,000 years. The one is such that you have the vision, and you have a 36,000 years old world that is just lying out there, being frozen in Siberian thermosphere, 5 years in Russia. So, we developed the surfaces of it. I found a number of articles. They are very much prestigious. So we have the Thomas Babhabi, molecular biologist at the University of Wyoming, who did contribute to the research. We have a lot of had a study and they found organisms surviving a much longer period than 46,000 years. For example, example, bacteria is supposed in amber for 25 million to 40 million years. Of course, the seed that it was germinated after spending 1,000 to 1,500 years in the ancient world. But it is kind of interesting to think that the longest nematode had been recorded to survive in prior topoids for 39 years. So now we have this one that was frozen for 46,000 years and got back to life, Dr. Roy.
Okay, it is AC2GS. Hopefully there won't be any shenanigans. You're relying too much on semi-decent journals. There's only one report on this 46,000-year-old worm. They've gotten a lot of satellite articles. One is from Scientific American, which I think I sent you a copy of it. You might have already seen it, in which there's a couple of paragraphs that qualify the heck out of it, suggest all the kind of cowardly little adjectives and such. The bottom line is, it is within the realm of possibilities that this was not a 46,000-year-old worm, because they didn't date the worm to 46,000 years. They dated some organic material in the ground nearby where they found the cystic worms. So the worms could have wandered by, 100 years ago, burrowed into 46,000-year-old ground and taken a very long nap and then been able to be brought back. So there's still a lot of questions and no great answers. But number one, it's not accurate to say definitively it's a 46,000-year-old worm, because they didn't take the worm, they just dated the permasoil, which is a different thing entirely.
Thank you very much for that. And the last thing, today, it was supposed to be a puzzle, and it is a puzzle, because the answer is not a simple question. Who is the inventor? Who was the inventor of television? Dr.
Farnsworth?
Any other answers?
No. Generally, I'm sure Russians have a Russian inventor of television, and I'm sure, unfortunately, if you ask the relatives of Lee DeForest, they'll tell you that he invented it in his sleep.
If anybody from the audience has the answer to the question, who was the inventor of television?
W-S-U-N. It was not the working. He came behind the actual inventor, KTJHR Vehicle Link.
Say again, please.
K2JHR via Echo Link. Workin has been a long time thought it was in the interest of television. No. Philo Farnsworth did this work well before Workin, and Workin just picked up on the work that was previously been put down by Farnsworth.
Okay, so you agree with me. That's always nice. Thank you. I appreciate that. Anyone else want to offer a comment on this puzzle?
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I have many books that tell me Farnsworth. Back to your right.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was taught as well. But I was also taught watching Star Trek as a child that the Russian crewman always suggested that it was invented by a little old lady in Moscow.
I thought Hedy Lamarr invented all modern electronics, WB2BX, though.
Yeah, that story has grown larger and larger through the ages. So I wouldn't at all be surprised if it ends up on some future Wikipedia in 100 years.
Okay, I see no other answers. So I'm going to come up with the answer. There is no single inventor. No single inventor deserves the credit for the television. Like everything, we should start from the beginning. So we have 1830 and 40s, and we have B. Moore. He actually made the system sending messages translated into beeping sounds. But then after that, we have Alexander Graham Bell, who made the telephone, which allowed human voice to travel through the wires of the long distances. And then after that, we have a Thomas Edison, who speculated about the possibility of telephone-like devices that could transmit images as well as the sound. And after that, we have 1884 Paul Nipkow, German, I believe, or German Jews, came up with the system sending images through the wires using the spinning disc. So you have a wire and you have two spinning discs that's supposed to spin at the same speed, and that was called electric telescope. Let me drop. But it was essentially an early form of mechanical television. Then, in 1900, we have a Russian physicist, Boris Wilsink, and a Scottish engineer, Alan Campbell, Swinton, who worked actually independently to improve the Nipkow system by replacing spinning discs with the cathode ray tubes, and the technology that developed earlier by German physicist Karl Braun, that was a Swinton system, if I remember, which placed the cathode ray tubes inside the camera that could send the picture as well as inside the receiver that was essentially the earliest electronic television system. And then we're coming to the famous Viktor Sorokin. He was a Russian. He worked as an assistant before emigrated, trying to escape Russian Revolution in 1923. Let me drop. He was employed in the Pittsburgh-based manufacturing company Westinghouse. So Westinghouse had, at the time before the Russian Revolution, the factory in Pittsburgh. And he applied first television patent for the econoscope, which used cathode ray tubes to transmit images. And then we have the the contribution of Scottish engineer John Bright, who actually did the first demonstrated true television before 50 scientists in the central London in 1927. But then we have another guy, David Swarnoff. He was also Russian. He was, we could say, on today's money, billionaire. He became a radio corporation, RCA, RCA, biggest communication company at that time, had. He was, because he was Russian, and the working was also Russian, they decided to work together, and that's how the television became a television. So in 1930, he hired the working to develop improved television technology for the company. Let's drop. And then we have a Philip Farnsworth. The American inventor has been working on his own television system. So Farnsworth grew up in a farm in Utah, reportedly came up with his idea of a vacuum tube that could dissect images into lines, transmit those lines. So we're talking about the first discovery, discovery of the lines. So how many lines has the image of the scanning?
Actually, the electron microscope, scanning microscope, with similar way to that, using the electron beam. And then we have the color television. So Farnsworth completed the prototype of first fully working television system based on image detector. But then we have the BBC TV broadcast in 1936, where Sarnoff used company marketing to introduce American public introduced the American public to television in a big way. That was the RCA Broadcasting Division, called National Broadcasting Company, NBC. So now we have the beginning of the NBC. Sarnoff broadcast was opening, was broadcasting the ceremony, including President Franklin D. Roosevelt inauguration. And the end of it is that by 1949, there was 1 million of television sets in United States, and they were quite expensive at that time. Imagine that it could cost the early version of it as much as a car. So it was not easy to have it, but there were still people with money to have it. I wonder how many people died at the, like my wife said, the Cybertruck. But still, I saw a few in the United States. Dr. Ray, back to you.
F2CC?
Yes?
I have history of television that goes, I understand, goes back a long way. And actually, it was contributions upon contributions upon contributions that really finalized the layout for television as we know it today. So I would think that Farnsworth was the person who put it into practical use.
Well, I would agree with you. I mean, if you want to play this game, we might as well include Hertz, because he discovered radio waves. But it gets kind of ridiculous. I mean, nothing is kind of popped into existence from the void. Everything builds on everything else. So you had oscilloscopes, you had strange image-generating devices that weren't quite televisions, but as far as history is concerned, if you look it up, you will find that good old Philo Farnsworth was working on it in the 1920s and presented the operational version of it in San Francisco September 7th, 1927. So as far as I'm concerned, when it comes to who invented the television, it's good old Philo. There were guys who perfected it, who improved it, who modified it, people who worked on things prior to its existence that couldn't, had to be done before you could build a proper television. But I think ultimately the short answer is Philo Farnsworth.
Well, actually, we could agree and disagree, because you may say who discovered the electromagnetic lab. We may say, well, at first there was a lock, and then there was an electromagnetic lock, but then we could go from the beginning of the electromagnetics or the experiment with coil. So I believe that the most fair answer is the mutual contribution by all of the guys who made that color television happen. Thank you.
Okay, that's your opinion, not mine. And no one really said color TV. You never mentioned who invented color TV. Black and white TV is a thing. And again, to name everyone involved in the technological advances in the general field that made televisions possible eventually just kind of dilutes everything and obscures everything. And instead of just being able to fit it into a single line, you have to write an essay on the subject. So again, the average person, when asked who invented the black and white television, is probably, if they know the answer, is going to tell you Philo Farnsworth. They are not going to write an essay. You know, same thing about the light bulb. Who invented the light bulb? Well, offhand, I don't recall. I know that Thomas Edison didn't invent the light bulb. He didn't even improve the light bulb. His scientists that he paid improved the light bulb, but the light bulb existed before Thomas Edison had anything to do with it. But again, if you turn it into a friggin' essay, then you know, most people will tune off frequency because people don't have that much patience.
So you have a good point, Dr. Wayne. What is happening right now is we're not going to discuss that because it's a space report time. But right now there is a court proceedings and investigation of that famous, famous accident with the submarine, the billionaire guy who came from the construction business and built the submarine, and he was trying to see Titanic, and it blew up, actually. Not blow up, it just stuck inside. I don't know how to use the proper word. You're going to use the proper word, Dr. Wright. So now, plenty of videos, plenty of material is there from the court proceeding, from the investigation journalists, and from the construction material professionals analyzing, because they found actually the vessel imploding inside. They found that the vessel, the bodies are not there at that pressure. So if you have a few words about it, you can say, and then you go to the space report, I can leave it for next conversation, Dr. Wright.
Yeah, if you want to leave it until next time. It's just, I think it's the one-year anniversary, so everyone is presenting all the information people discovered over the last year, and it comes across that the guy in charge was a real son of a, and just an idiot, and cut a lot of corners, did a lot of dangerous things, and eventually it was going to blow up on him. So, yeah, it imploded. We can talk about it next week if you want. But it's sort of the same story as it was last year. It was just a guy who thought he was invulnerable. I feel bad for the billionaire's son who got guilt-tripped into going with his father for a Father's Day present. So, you know, he gave his life for a Father's Day present, a heck of a gift. The other people, you know, they wanted to do this, so that's what you get. Anyway, thanks, Wes, as always. David, do you mind? We're running really late tonight. Could we possibly table your question for, say, next Sunday? David, KG2RY, are you out there? Okay, nothing much heard. I guess he's doing something else. Anyway, thanks everyone who participated tonight. Hope you learned some things. Hope you were entertained a little bit, and I hope you weren't bored too much. We have all kinds of different subjects. Some are very simple. Some are very complicated. I try my best to kind of soften the load for the complicated things as best I can. So I hope you all appreciated it. Now it's time for Paul, WS2N, with the SpaceNet Report.
fine business, Roy. And AC2GSWS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Okay, we'll go through a couple of topics. We got some time here. So 3 days ago, you had a launch from Japan, and they put up a bunch of satellites. They're radar satellites, but the thing is, they use the H2A rocket. Japan has heavy lift rockets, and they're called one's called the H2A, and another one's the H2B, and a new one that they've been developing for the last 5 to 8 years, I guess, is the H3. H3 is designed to replace both of these. H3 is less expensive to build and more powerful. So the mission was a success. They got it off the ground. And the reason I bring it up is that the H2B was only used for NASA for sending cargo up to the International Space Station when they had the HTV cargo vehicle, and it used to launch almost once a year, and they did that for 9 years in a row. They're building a new one, a new cargo. Naturally, it's going to be able to carry more weight, more innovative, and eventually that will be also being sent to not only the space station but future space stations as well, that capability, and that will all be on the new H3 rocket. And they've had one successful launch with the H3 rocket already, so now they plan on a couple more the beginning of next year, which is a good deal. They need that rocket not only for cargo going to the space station, but they're going to need it for eventually cargo going to another space station, but called Gateway. Gateway will be the one space station that will be orbiting the moon. So they have plans on helping out with the Artemis program. The ongoing plans for Artemis is to land another vehicle on the moon every year. So hopefully they'll be able to start that soon. So, let me drop it. And just a couple of few days ago, they had, the day before Saturday, they had astronaut Daisy T. Dyson returns from the International Space Station with the two Russians. And the two Russians spent over a year on station. Tracy, the American astronaut, spent roughly six months on the space station, and successfully came back in a Russian vehicle, and that worked out well. The time that these people are spending in orbit, each astronaut is getting longer and longer. The one guy, one of the two guys that came back from Russia, that was over a year. He's been up like four different times, and he's collectively got 1,111 days in space. So they're doing better and better with keeping people in orbit, which eventually they'll need to do if they ever get to go to Mars. That will be roughly a 3-year mission. And they'll be able to, they need to know that they could do something like that. Let me drop it. Okay, now that those three are safely back, before that they had sent up another crew with another American astronaut as well. So now they were back to seven. The goal is to get back to seven astronauts. That's the standard number on the space station. So they've been up to nine, and up and down, depending on the crews that are coming and going. So yesterday, at 1:17 in the afternoon, I got to watch a launch from Florida, which carried just two crew members up to the International Space Station. And one guy was Nick Hague, he's the commander. And then the other guy is a Russian, Alexander Gorbunov. Just the two of them. And they went up in a Falcon rocket, which normally carries four people. That is the rocket that you hear on the news is saving the two stranded astronauts. That's the way the news puts it. They're really not stranded. These are all Plan B plans that go on with the space program. So the two that went up there on the Starliner, you know, back on June 5th they launched, will not be coming back until February, and they'll be coming back with Nick Hague and with Alexander Gorbunov. They'll be filling in the other two seats. So, you know, Falcon has the capability of bringing four up. They only went up with two, but they're going to come down with four. By the way, Nick Hague is a ham, KG5TMB. So when he's up there, he'll be making some school contacts, I'm sure. Most of them do that. And then one of the people he's going to bring back, Sonny Williams, she's also a ham. So, and right now they gave her the job of commander of the International Space Station. What happened was, for a year and a half, Hague and Gorbunov, they've been training for this mission. You know, they're going to stay up there for 6 months, but they were training with two other Americans, two women, Zena Cardman and Stephanie Wilson. Stephanie Wilson, she's been up, I think, two or three times before, and Zena Cardman, well, she never got a chance to go up. And they wind up cut from this flight. I'm sure they'll get flights in the future. Right now they're officially cut. And they were doing commentary for NASA when this flight was going up yesterday. And by the way, there was a special magazine by National Geographic that came out that just had the word space on it. All the things that's going on with the human space flight and robotic space flight. But one of the people they highlighted in that book was Zena Cardman. They showed her training and what it's going to be like, you know, when they go to the moon. So, yeah, it's really, I mean, and that book just came out about a month ago. So it's really strange that she was one of the people, of course, that were cut. Stephanie Wilson, she was supposed to go up with her in that same Dragon vehicle. And that's the one I said that's been up two or three times before. They were going to make her the commander of the International Space Station when she got up there. So she missed out on that job. But they replaced her with another woman. That's Sony Williams, which was, you know, just Sony and Butch Wilmore were the two that went up on Starliner. And they're going to be coming back down in February on a SpaceX vehicle, a Dragon crew vehicle. So there you go. That's the update on those recent flights, you know, coming down and going up. WS2N, any comments?
KE2AJU. Charlie, this is Paul. This is Charlie.
Yeah, good evening, Charlie. How are you? And good to hear your voice.
Excellent, excellent. Now, this cosmonaut's been up for 1,100 days. How long can you stay in space before you start having muscle problems?
Well, they all exercise at least 2 hours a day when you go to the space station. And that's to stop that atrophy from happening to your muscles. If they didn't do that, you know, inside of a couple of weeks, they would start to have some serious problems. But they all exercise. They have the equipment up there to do that. treadmills and all. And the 1,100 days, well, that's collectively. He's been up. That guy had to. That was his fifth flight up there. So collectively, he's got the 1,100 days. But this last flight that he did come back down on was 374 days. So it was just over a year, along with the other fellow that came back with him. They were both up there for the same time, just over a year. In fact, they broke Frank Rubio's record, which he was up a couple of years ago. He made it to just over a year, and these guys beat that record by 4 days, which is not that exciting or newsworthy anymore. I mean, this is going to be going on for years. In the future, people will be breaking one record after the other. I mean, a total amount of people that have flown to space already, starting in January, either suborbital or orbital, we're already up to 49 people. I keep track of that. So, including the Chinese, Takanauts, they call them. There's three of them up there. And right now it is, they had seven up there, so that gives us 11. I guess we have 14 people flying in space right now. Back to you, John.
Yeah, I'm asking because if you get an astronaut going to Mars, it's going to take him, what, 2 years to get there, time there, and 2 years to get back? I'm just curious how much exercise that man would have.
Yeah, well, it's right now they do 2 hours a day, and that seems to be okay. I mean, they're still in proper shape when they come back. I watched the landing of Tracy Dyson and the two cosmonauts that she came back with vehicle. And when they got out of that vehicle, it landed upright. Sometimes it doesn't, but it landed upright. And they opened up the hatch on top, and they set up this ladder. And this all happens in Kazakhstan. That's where the Russians land. They don't land in Russia. They land in a different country, Kazakhstan. And they set up a slide, and they pull them out one at a time, and they slide them down the slide. And then from there, they physically carry them in a chair. And they have three chairs, and they're sitting around. They don't get up and just start walking. And from there, they talk to them, make sure they're okay. Tracy Dyson, she was very happy. She got a whole bunch of flowers. But they carried the three of them into a medical tent that they set up out in the middle of Kazakhstan. And from there, they get checked out, get out of their flight suits, get into more comfortable suits, and eventually they make their way to helicopters take them to a city in Kazakhstan. From there, they fly to their respected countries. Russians fly back to Star City in Moscow, and Tracy eventually gets on with the rest of the NASA support team that meets her. And they get on, from the helicopter, they get onto the airplane and fly. I think they stop off in Germany first, and then from Germany they fly to Houston. And I guess by that time, when they get off the plane in Houston, she's probably able to walk around pretty good, which really makes you think. From goes back to your question. By the way, the minimum amount of time to get to Mars would be around 6 months right now, so not a year, but 6 months. The plan is right now anyway. The plan is to fly there, to take 6 months to fly there and stay on Mars for about a year or so until the planets align again, when they're close together again, and then they fly back. We'll take another 6 months. They need roughly 2.5 years to do a Mars mission. So you know, that's a long way from now. I'm sure that those time numbers will change. But it makes you think that, you know, imagine spending 6 months in space. First of all, they're going to launch, you know, directly to Mars. There is a talk of launching from the moon to Mars. I don't believe that will ever happen. Well, not in our lifetime, anyway. My guess is they'll probably launch from Earth, and it would take 6 months to get to Mars. But you're still in bad shape after 6 months. All right, there's roughly one-third the gravitational pull on Mars, which would help when they land. You know, it's actually 0.38, 38 hundredths of what you feel on Earth. So, you know, if you weigh 100 pounds, you know, you're only going to weigh 38 pounds on Mars. So that'll help a little bit, but still, you're going to be in bad shape when you land. And then there's not going to be anybody, well, in the beginning, there's not going to be anybody there to help you out of your spacecraft. So they've got a long way to go. Anyway, back to you, John.
Paul, is there any way, I know this sounds far-fetched, but is there any way to make gravity?
Yeah, it's not far-fetched. I mean, you know, they've experimented with that. In fact, the International Space Station at one time was being funded. They were going to attach this spinning modules on the front end of the space station where right now you have node 2, which is called a Harmony module. And they were... The theory was to attach the axis of this big contraption, and you would actually have a spinning wheel with actual modules. Hard to describe, but you know, picture a couple of modules put together, you know, in a circle, and then it would be rotating, and then to be able to use that like sleeping quarters, and that would help, you know, you'd have some kind of gravity. It wouldn't be equivalent to Earth, but it would be something. And, of course, that idea was scrapped for a number of reasons. They didn't want this spinning thing going all the time. That would affect the attitude of the whole space station. They'd constantly have to be readjusting that. For a number of reasons, they canceled that idea. But, yeah, you could have something like that on the way to Mars again in the future. In the beginning, it would be too costly to develop something like that, and you could have a spinning setup that would actually do that. They've experimented all the way back in the Gemini days. Remember the Gemini missions? They'd fly two people at one time. One of the missions was to attach to an Agena rocket. They launched the Agena rocket first, about an hour before the Gemini would launch, and they eventually docked with it. Let me drop it. So the two people would be attached to this other Agena rocket that has no people in it. One of the things that they did was they had a tether. And they attached it to the Agena spacecraft, and then they would back off with this thing, fire their thrusters, and they would back off. Now they're stretched out. I think it was 100 feet or so, and then they fire their thrusters again, and the whole setup started revolving, and the idea was to create the sense of gravity in the Gemini spacecraft. And as it was moving, they felt that the control of it wasn't there, so they disconnected early and cancel that experiment. But they did give that a try to see if they could do something like that. So it's you know, they've thought about it for years, but right now it's still not practical. It would be a very expensive endeavor to create some kind of spinning wheel that's going to fly all the way to Mars. But yeah, that would be great if they could do it. And someday they will. You know, early flights, you know, maybe is, you know, are probably going to be direct flights with no gravity. But somewhere along the line, somebody's going to say, okay, let's do this. You know, they know it would work, but the cost of it must be phenomenal. Back to you, Charlie. WS2M.
If you're going to colonize the moon and other planets, okay, you've got to have gravity so the body doesn't deteriorate. You know, your muscles get weaker and weaker because they're getting used to no gravity. And in order to travel from one planet to the other, you're going to have it.
Yeah, well, in the beginning, they won't. Just like now, on a space station, there's no gravity. They constantly exercise, you know, under that microgravity situation. They'll do that all the way to Mars. But, yeah, if you plan on, you know, colonizing Mars with hundreds of people or thousands of people, there's going to have to be a better system than, you know, than just floating all the way there. And then the problem is when you're on Mars, you know, it's still one-third the gravity of Earth. And that's got to affect you after a while as well. And the moon is even worse. That's only one-sixth the gravity. So, you know, if you're living on the moon, I'm sure they're going to require people, you know, in this moon base to be exercising on a regular basis. Just, you know, living on the one-sixth gravity, can't be good for your muscles either. Anyway, I just wanted to comment before we get to the witching hour here about Firefly, another rocket company. You know, Firefly has been launched. They've launched like five rockets now, and from California, and it's a medium, small to medium. A lift rocket, and they, you know, they've been successful, and they have financing. They plan on they're presently building a lunar lander called the Blue Ghost. So you know they're pretty innovative, and they're also building, you know, they make their own engines, and now they're building a bigger engine called the Miranda. Which will eventually fly something called the medium lift vehicle. Medium launch vehicle that we're planning on launching from Vandenberg Air Force Base, and they're going to do it for Northrop Grumman. So Northrop Grumman is back, you know, putting a lot of money in to help Firefly. And the latest plan for Firefly for this new medium launch vehicle is to have this one reusable, similar to what SpaceX does. They plan on having it come down, and SpaceX has these big arms that are sticking out that's going to catch the booster as it lands. And these people are thinking about the same thing, but they have some other thoughts too. They might have these big heavy wires, these cables, you know, mounted on like four poles. And the booster might come down and just catch these cables and then land it that way, you know. But make a long story short, they plan on eventually, you know, making another reusable vehicle, which is going to, you know, these companies are coming out left and right, you know, not anytime soon, but eventually they'll be competing with SpaceX, and that's practically a monopoly going on now. Not quite, but that's one of them. And then there's another one by the French space agency. And that this one's called Maya Space, M-A-I-A Space. There's a French over CNES, C-N-E-S, that's the that's like NASA for France. They're starting to develop this engine for the rocket, and they now have a place to launch it to. They'll launch it from French Guiana down in South America, where the Aryan company launches the launch vehicle. They used to launch Aryan 5 and 3, but one of the rockets they used to launch on a regular basis was the Soyuz rocket. They used to buy them from Russia. Now they can't do that anymore because there's all kinds of restrictions now with Russia because of the Ukrainian war. So now this big launch complex down in French Guiana has been vacated. So now the Maya space company with Maya rockets will be taking over. They've already started refurbishing that launch complex. And it turns out this Maya rocket is also going to be built with reusability in mind. So a lot of that's coming down the road. Rocket Lab has one. It's the one that they're launching now called Electron. It's going to be reusable as well. And they have a big rocket called the Neutron rocket by Rocket Lab that will also be reusable. That's a good size rocket. That's bigger than a medium lift vehicle, medium to heavy lift, I would say. So a lot to look forward to in the years to come. And we have more to cover. I can cover this stuff from that I have here for next week. No big deal. I'm looking at the witching hour. And thank you, Charlie, for contributing. But now I'm going to turn it back to Roy, ACTGS, WS2N, for the SpaceNet report. For the TechNet, we'll be back next week, hopefully. Back to you, Roy.
K2CYR is a question.
Oh, okay. Stand by, Roy. Somebody said they had a question.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. This is K2CYR. First name is Ray. Just curious, in the subject of astronauts going into outer space, water, I understand, is readily available, but I'm not too sure, or maybe you should explain to me, what about nutrition? How do they feed themselves? How do they get fed? Is the food processed, pre-processed? What goes on there in terms of nutrition for those astronauts or the space travelers there? Thank you.
Oh, okay, you're talking about food that they have up on the International Space Station? They're loaded with food. They have all kinds of stuff. They heat it up. I understand they don't have a microwave. They have something more closer to a like a toaster oven. And they say the food is quite good now. Back in the 60s, I used to watch the launches, and they used to have food, and it looked like toothpaste. That's what it looked like, and they would force it into their mouth, and they're pretty gross, but those days are long over. So they have special foods for certain people that like certain things. They make sure that that's on board. The Russian cuisine, they say, is much different than the American side. So, yeah. I understand that the food is supposed to be very good. It's not a turkey dinner, but it's pretty good, they said. Back to you.
Thanks for clarifying that for me. I was more concerned about the preparation and how it is preserved, et cetera, et cetera. But you pretty much gave me a good example. all it was, because I got the feeling, like you said, in the 60s, that they got fed through, or they fed themselves through toothpaste-type tubes, which is gross, like you said. But you're telling me now that they're more modernized in terms of preparing meals and so forth, et cetera, et cetera. I well understand that it's not like your kitchen...